Welcome to What the Paper Said, in which I, Patrick Crozier, skim through the Times from 100 years ago, read some of the articles, and comment on the ones I find interesting. In this episode, the week ending the 15th of July 1923, whaling, the case against passports, the future of freedom, global warming 1920 style, Nancy Astor is a killjoy, and finally someone puts an end to the scourge of the £3 loaf, plus waterboards, sad news for the Queen Mother, and an air race. That's a race in the air, not Manfred von Richthofen sort of machine-gunning people. But first, the headlines. Not many headlines, but though they are actually quite important. First of all, at Lausanne, now the Turks and the Allies have been yammering away to one another for well over 6 months now. And it looks as if they're going to come to an agreement. Which is odd because, spoiler alert, to the best of my knowledge, what they do agree on actually has lasted to this day. Someone will doubtless correct me in the comments, but that's what I believe. The other big story is that the mark has managed to reach 1 million to the pound. For reference, it was 10 to the pound, or maybe it was 20 to the pound. I think it was 10 to the pound. No, it was 20 to the pound at the outbreak of the First World War. In other news, there's been a correspondence about the price of season tickets. Some people are complaining and are demanding the government step in. That's one of the problems with the grouping system. Is that the government has given itself that power. There's an air race in progress. I can't off the top of my head remember the name, but it is from London, Hendon, as it happens, a place I've visited many times. Hendon, Birmingham, Newcastle, Glasgow, Liverpool, Bristol, and back to London. And so far, I think they got to Glasgow. We shall see who wins. It's likely to be a de Havilland, by the way. On Wednesday, there was an all-night storm. It appears to have been quite a humdinger, as several buildings were burnt to the ground. And on Friday, they recorded a temperature of 91 degrees Fahrenheit in the shade. So, are scientists writing letters to the Times, warning our ancestors of the danger of a warming planet? Are newspapers demanding an explanation for all this extreme weather? Are politicians and plutocrats taking to their private ocean liners on their way to international conferences in glamorous locations to be lectured by Swedish schoolgirls? Are Just Stop Coal gluing themselves to tram tracks? No. No, they're not. In the days when I was a teenager, one of the great inconveniences, amongst many, was the law on alcohol. You had to chance it. Sometimes you could convince a landlord that you were over 18. Sometimes you couldn't. With universal photo ID these days, I can only imagine it's a lot harder. So who is responsible for this law? The first woman to take her seat in the House of Commons, that's who. Or Nancy Astor, to give her a name. The law in question has just received its third reading. This means that it's almost certain to become law. On Saturday the 14th, the Times had an editorial. Its official backers belonged to all parties in the House, and in the country it was supported not only by the heads of the established, the Roman Catholic, and all the free churches, but by the great bulk of the medical and teaching professions, and practically by all women interested in the welfare of the young of both sexes. As a standby for the young in the difficult period of adolescence, it will prove a valuable addition to the law of the land. So, was it a valuable addition to the law of the land? Had it made the world a better place? It certainly didn't make my world a better place, and I'm sure I can speak for millions of, millions, perhaps all my readers, or the vast majority of my readers. If you disagree, please let me know. I mean, it is worth pointing out that in this editorial, they do not have any criteria for failure. So there's no test which this law can fail. and therefore be shown to be a bad law. But all we can say is, in one of the debates or discussions about this bill, a number of 2,000 under 18-year-olds being found drunk by the police every year. What's the number today, I wonder? I would be amazed if it were less. I think it might also be worth pointing out that when these laws get passed, it's a hell of a job to get them repealed. I'm really far from sure we'd get any great support nowadays, but hey, you never know. By the way, in case you are asking yourself what was the age limit beforehand, I don't know. I'm afraid I think I did at one point, but I've forgotten what it was. I had this awful suspicion there was no lower age limit before this bill came into force. Hey, I'm assuming it's coming into force, but I don't know. Yes, it's the law of the land now, but is this the bill that actually made that law? I suspect it is, but I could be wrong. You never know. We'll just have to see. In real life, the other week, Thames Water went bust, and I think I know why. This is from Saturday the 14th. The Metropolitan Water Board, that is the Thames Water's predecessor, yesterday decided to discontinue the practice of allowing parties to visit the board's works for the purpose of shooting wildfowl. Or maybe the weight of government regulation, price control and the heavy dollar of native incompetence did for it. In the courts, it's been determined that a £1 loaf is legal, a £2 loaf is legal, a £4 loaf is legal, but a £3 loaf is not. Don't you just love silly laws? By the way, I wonder if this might be related to something you may have experienced when drinking abroad. Now, if you go to, say, Belgium, and you go into a bar, the beer is poured out into a glass with a beer maker's name on it, of a certain size, and often it's a very different size, but depending on what beer you're drinking. I think it's wonderful. But to do that in this country is totally illegal, because beer, I think I'm right in saying, can only be sold in something like pints, half pints, I think it may be a third of a pint. They may have had fewer laws in 1923, but they didn't have no laws. On Thursday the 12th, the Times reported that an Angus Patrick Bowes Lyon had been found dead in his car. You may be familiar with the Bowes Lyon bit, because that was the maiden name of the then Duchess of York, or the Queen Mother, as most of us, or more of us, will be familiar with. This chap is indeed her cousin, and he shot himself, and it appears to be over a woman. In benighted foreign parts, not much to say this week, but that guy, Hitler, has claimed that three saboteurs sentenced to death by the French in the Ruhr are Nazis. Not that he would use the term Nazis at that time, or indeed the Times uses the term Nazis, but his bunch. And now for Signs of the Times. Last week I mentioned that I'd found an example of tyre being spelt with an I. This week I found an example of tyre being spelt with a Y. So obviously there's a certain conflict going on. Why that conflict should end up with the Y version winning out, I have no idea. On Tuesday the 10th, the Times published this in the In Brief section. At Surrey Assizes yesterday, Patrick Joseph Honan, 26, medical practitioner, was found guilty of performing an illegal operation at Croydon on May the 25th and was sentenced to 18 months imprisonment with hard labour. Well, apart from the sentence, my goodness, what's interesting is the phrase they use, medical practitioner. I'm just a little bit curious as to what that means, because he hasn't got the word doctor in front of his name. So what is his status? I mean, this is, the General Medical Council, or whatever it's called, that came into existence about, I think it's about 1850, 1860. Let's check. 1858, it would appear. But I thought that meant that in order to practice, you had to be a doctor, and this guy doesn't have doctor in front of his name. Anyway, not that it matters. He's going to jail for a good long time. I mentioned in the 1st of July episode that there's been an outbreak of smallpox. This has generated some correspondence on the subject of vaccination. This is a letter from a Herbert Dunelm from Monday the 9th, and it's in reply to a Professor Pollard. I agree with the professor that individual freedom can never be unconditioned. As society becomes more complex, vaster, and more closely knit, the conditions become ever more numerous and more severe. The rights of the individual grow ever fewer until the question begins to press for answer. Are there any individual franchises left? Interesting choice of words. Anyway, he goes on. Can we say with respect to any personal concern that there, at least, self-respect requires that liberty shall be unchecked? My conscience, my religion, my home, my property, can a ring fence be placed around any of them, and even the state compelled to respect it? Well, one would kind of hope so. Anyway, he goes on. Broadly, the community must protect itself against the mischiefs which may flow from a perverted conscience, a demoralizing religion, a disordered home, a misused property, really, and of the perversion, demoralization, disorder, and misuse, the community itself must be the judge. Well, that's casting your net pretty wide, I'd have to say. Salus populi suprema lex. For those who don't know, that means the welfare of the population is the supreme law. The sole ultimate right left to the individual is the right at all hazards to disobey the state in the interest of his own self-respect. I'd love to know if that can be... How can I put it? Well, let's put it this way. That sounds too vague to have any real meaning. He goes on. I should judge the American policy of prohibition to be short-sighted, mistaken, and in its ultimate consequences, mischievous. Mischievous. But I cannot challenge the right of the community, in what it conceives to be its own interest, to forbid the manufacture, sale, and consumption of alcoholic beverages. And I am quite sure that it is a bad blunder to allow the public health to be jeopardized by the refusal of individuals to be vaccinated. Eh? I mean, surely the point about smallpox vaccination is that if you are vaccinated, you can't get it, or at least you cannot suffer from it. So what's that got to do with anyone else? I'm far from clear that this is allowing the public health to be jeopardized, as he puts it. By the way, Dunelm would appear to be the author of a book called A Yellow Spot, which was published in the 1930s, and talks about the destruction of the Jewish race in Germany, or, as he puts it, the destruction of the German race, which is pretty good going since it was written in the, as I said, the mid-30s, about 1936, I believe. Well, I assume he wrote it anyway. A Herbert Dunelm wrote it, and I can't imagine there were too many Herbert Dunelms at the time. An altogether more robust defence of freedom, albeit a very specific one, was offered in a letter published on Wednesday the 17th of July from a Neville Lytton. Before the war, the only country where passports were necessary was Russia, and rightly it was thought that this was a sign that that unfortunate country was wallowing in barbarism. During the war, millions have laid down their lives, not so much for king and country, as for liberty. And what is the result? We have less liberty than we ever had before. Of course, the police and the Home Office like the passport system, but then they like all forms of tyranny. Well, thank goodness all those days are long behind us. Thank goodness we live in an age where the police are there to stop burglaries and murders and not to arrest people for expressing the wrong opinion. He goes on. Is it right that we should submit to this tyranny? Do the police exist for the public, or does the public exist for the police? Well, you might ask. In present circumstances, this last would appear to be the case. Frontiers are a sufficient nuisance in themselves without the addition of passports. Let us abolish them. Mind you, it does make you wonder how the authorities determined whether an arrival at a port should be allowed entry or not without a passport. Accent, knowledge of English, bearing. But there would still have been some people who had been immigrants. What about them? On Tuesday, the Times published an article on whaling. It was a thing in those days. The method of the industry has also changed. The captures are no longer stripped of their blubber and whalebone at sea, but are towed to elaborate factories on shore. In these establishments, almost every part of the carcass is utilised. Train oil, sperm oil, spermaceti, baleen and ambergris. Ambergris? Are carefully prepared. The meat is used as human food and is held to be excellent by those who have tasted it. Is that my view on whale meat? On the basis of one instance, I would say it has the taste of beef and the texture of kidney. Anyway, he goes on. The refuse and the bones are turned into various forms of guano. The favourite localities are in South Georgia and the South Shetlands, islands which are dependencies of the Falklands, and therefore under British jurisdiction, although actually the commercial interests are largely in the hands of Norwegian firms. Well, that wouldn't be the first time that the Norwegians are better than us at exploiting natural resources. Or maybe it is the first time. Although, those of you who remember the Falklands War, or are familiar with the Falklands War, will perhaps have a sense of déjà vu, because the very first chapter in that was when a bunch of allegedly Argentine, well, or supposedly, not allegedly, supposedly Argentine scrap metal dealers pitched up on South Georgia to dismantle an old, disused whaling station. Almost certainly one of the ones they're talking about here. As it happened, these whalers seemed to be more interested in drilling and putting up Argentine flags. Anyway, that's all for this week. I aim to have something up next week, but I promise nothing.